Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician Becky Mosser, and today's guest is Dr. Karen Tobias of the University of Tennessee. Dr. Tobias, thanks so much for being here with me today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm excited for our conversation today centered around your article in the February 2020 edition of Clinician's Brief, Top 5 Complications of Gonadectomy. And I've got a lot of questions for you, and we're going to dive into all that. But first, just tell me a little around your background. Where did you come from and how did you end up in Tennessee?
Well, I graduated from veterinary college at University of Illinois and spent a lot of time at various places doing internships, residencies, clinical instructorships, and then eventually made my way over to University of Tennessee and took a position here as an associate professor, and now I'm a tenured full professor.
And were you one of those individuals who knew they wanted to be a veterinarian your whole life, or did it come on later? Tell me a little about that.
Well, I knew I wanted to work with animals, but my thought was that I could be a forest ranger and ride through the forest on a horse, saving small animals. And then I grew up and realized that I probably needed a real job. So I went right into veterinary medicine, figuring that would allow me to either buy that horse or save those small animals.
Yeah. And did you do both?
One of two. Pretty good.
One of two. Okay. Still working on the horse?
Yeah.
And then what about your specialty? Like, at what point in time do you decide, you know, where you want to be in terms of specializing?
I knew that pretty early on that I wanted to teach. My parents are both teachers, and so I definitely wanted to teach. And I also found pretty early on that I had very good hand skills. I don't see faces very well, but I can feel things with my hands. So when there's a problem that's there, sometimes my hands can go without me. It's a little bit like playing the piano, where people eventually learn how to play and they don't have to think about it. And so I actually started doing surgery during veterinary college years and did some pretty challenging procedures. Even my first year in veterinary college, I didn't know that they were challenging at the time. But now when I look back, I think, oh my gosh, I can't believe I cannulated the thoracic ducts of nude rats. I mean, that's amazing. So I found out that that's where my skill was probably best suited, but I also enjoyed the teaching part. And so this combination of teaching and doing surgery is perfect for me.
And that's, you know, I mean, that's just like the most beautiful thing, right? That's like what we all want, is to be able to work within what we're good at, but also what we love. So I love that you've done that. And kind of bringing it back to this piece, I honestly was excited to talk about this because I found this piece to be rather enlightening. And when I say basic, you know, I don't mean basic in a demeaning way. I just mean, I think the things we take for granted, like we started doing them first and we do them all the time. And so I think we do get a little lackadaisical or complacent around some of these more repetitive procedures, right?
I agree totally. And I think it comes from both sides. It's not only the people who are doing the procedures out in practice over and over. This is the way we've always done it. This is the way we're going to do it. But it's also those of us who are teaching them. I mean, I taught people for years that we should spay animals at a young age and that we should do pre-scrotal castrations so that we didn't damage the scrotum. And then to find out that, hey, I'm wrong. It's actually very exciting. It's wonderful to see that there has been some progress made in these basic procedures, but also the times are changing and we need to change along with them.
Yeah. And that's a great point. Is I love that you bring to light the fact that we can teach the differences from the beginning as we learn to do better. And then also just the importance of being humble, right? And saying we're learning all the time that there's ways to do things better. And so I think that was kind of another area, was just the fact that we need to be looking at all aspects of what we do, even the most quote unquote basics, as, hey, I haven't listened to anything on or read anything on this and what's new in this space. And when I was reading your article, I guess another thing that I started to think about was the classification of complications and how we may quote unquote kind of write off some things that you define as complications as normal side effects. So talk to me a little bit and define complication for me in these contexts.
I do think it is a very individualistic definition, because certainly there are people out there who feel that, hey, these animals are not going to be painful after the surgery, or maybe they're going to be painful for a couple of hours. And yet some of the studies have showed us that even after a cat castration, these cats can have more limited activity for about 3 days. I mean, who who would have thought about that? And so I think it's really, really important for us to consider these types of things. An interesting thing that happened to me more recently was learning from an animal shelter that they felt it was totally normal for all of their dog castrations to have scrotal hematomas after the procedure. And that was because they were turning those dogs loose, like very vigorous activity, immediately after the surgery. And so for them, it was totally normal to have a giant scrotal hematoma. But me, that's a big complication. So I think it's a very individual definition, but I do think we need to take into consideration things like what shape is the incision in and how comfortable are the animals and how much bleeding should we really expect?
Sure. And I like the fact that you even bring the fact that pain maybe needs to just be considered a complication.
That idea about analgesia, I think it's changed a lot over the last 20 years specifically, that we used to say, oh, animals, if they suffer a little pain, that's good because it'll keep them quiet.
Yeah.
But none of us would really appreciate suffering pain. And so we also learned about the negative effects that anxiety, stress, and pain can have on the animals. So I do believe that it's much more common now for people to prescribe some pain relievers for these animals and to just try and put themselves in their pets' places and their owners' places. We may not see, based on some of the things that we study, we may not actually see that evidence of pain. Maybe that puppy comes in and it's so excited or stressed by our change in the environment that it doesn't show anything until it comes home. And then the owner saying, well, you know, he's just laying around. For us, that could be overlooked by a veterinarian. But the owners really realize, I just don't think that this is my normal dog. And yeah, it would be nice for them to not suffer.
Yeah. And so I love the idea of looking at this article and thinking about what do I consider to be normal and reevaluating a normal, quote unquote, there really is no normal complication, right? I guess that was my major takeaway.
Yes, I think if we all define complications similarly, where we're looking at pain and infection and swelling and things like that, that we need to consider all of those things and see how we can reduce them by either improving our procedures or providing better postoperative management or something like that.
Okay, and so that's a perfect segue to really my next question for you, which is, tell me what is new over the last 20 years? What are these best practices? And, you know, where have we come and from where we have been in terms of something just as quote unquote simple as gonadectomy?
Well, I suppose that where we're going with them might be more of the minimally invasive procedures in terms of, say, the laparoscopic ovarian hysterectomies. I think that that will be the place where we can make the most incredible advances. But a lot of those things are going to be outside of the realm of what we do in normal practice. So within normal practice, I just think some of the papers that have come out lately have been pretty fascinating, like the comparison of scrotal versus prescrotal castration. I had been teaching my students for years that you shouldn't clip and prep the scrotum because that's going to cause inflammation and irritation. And then here comes this paper that says, guess what? There are fewer incisional complications if we can do a scrotal castration instead of a prescrotal castration in dogs. That was mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
That's crazy. But then I started to look really closely at what was happening in castrations and realized all the tissue handling that's required with suturing those prescrotal incisions, all the stretching that we need. And maybe all of those things are actually detrimental. And maybe a simple incision right over the testicles and taking the testicles out without so much tissue handling makes more sense. I mean, that's what we do in piglets. That's what we do in lambs. That's what we do in horses. And here this whole time, we've been thinking dogs were different. And so something as simple as that, I mean, I personally consider that advance, even though other people might say, well, that just takes us back to the farm. Well, you know, maybe the farm was a good idea.
There's a lot of validity to that and just the fact of the emphasis of what you're saying in terms of opening our mind, right? And just saying, I stepped back. This thing blew my mind. I thought that can't be possible. And I stepped back and I thought, okay, well, maybe we do need to look at this and maybe what we used to do is better. Maybe we haven't come up with the best yet. But those incisional complications are what you listed as the number one complication. What are some other common incisional complications that you're seeing that we could be doing better and avoiding?
Well, I think that we do see a lot of swelling. It's interesting for me that when I watch students doing spays, I see that there is a lot of swelling around the cat spay incisions. And in some cases, they even look like hernias. And I think that all has to do with tissue handling. And so for a while, I was telling my students, well, let's not close the subcutaneous tissue. That'll decrease the amount of tissue handling that we have. And there was a paper that looked at microscopic changes being slightly greater when we didn't close the subcutaneous tissue in cats, but that grossly there was no difference. So I thought, oh, well, let's do less handling. Well, then a paper came out, I think Mark Bowling was the author on that one, and they looked at the differences in healing in cats versus dogs and in cats with incisions where we didn't close the subcutis versus where we did. And it turns out that cats rely very, very heavily on their subcutaneous tissues to provide blood supply to the skin. And closing those subcutaneous tissues is going to improve healing. And so for an experienced surgeon, a good surgeon, a person who's been out in general practice doing a lot of spays, it makes sense to go ahead and close the subcutaneous tissue because that's going to help the animal. For a student, it makes sense that you better start practicing your tissue handling and not damage the tissue quite so much. That's probably why you're getting all the swelling.
What a great point, too, and to think about the different aspects that causing it. Because as we develop our skills, it doesn't mean it isn't various aspects of our performance or our procedure that are causing those complications. So it's a really great point. And I love the idea of just being cognizant of general of what are causing these, quote unquote, what we consider to be routine. What about suture reaction? I mean, I think this is another space that we feel like, oh, yep, it happens.
What I would say is that in rare cases, I will see an animal that has a true suture reaction. And that is where they are reacting to the chemicals within that suture material. And if that happens, we see multiple areas of redness. We see drainage. We see almost like there's a cellulitis. There's inflammation all the way around it. And many of those animals require resection of that tissue and the placement of a totally new suture. I think that's a true suture reaction. On the other hand, we see animals who are licking at their sutures, and that suture site a lot of times is closed with an intradermal pattern, and they may be licking at it because either the knot is exposed, so we haven't appropriately closed the incision line, or the tissues have been handled a lot and the animals are actually irritated. And once they start licking at it, they start getting this more repetitive behavior. So I think we have to be a little bit cautious about the term suture reaction, really, because I think that it's not necessarily a reaction to the chemicals. It may actually be a reaction to what we've done.
Oh, and you know, we're always promised they're never licking it.
Yeah, right. Just like we don't scratch at our own wound.
Right. Yes, he's wearing the e-collar. No, I promise he hasn't been licking it. Oh, I love it. But you know, I love that changed mindset because I think we do kind of just, oh, yep, it's just this immediately. And I think we need to be more cognizant of, again, our role in what we may be contributing to these reactions and how we can just be doing better. And then again, you know, maybe preparing our clients for this is what happens if this occurs. I think a lot of times we just tell them to do things and assume that they understand the consequences. And so I think being really clear about what can happen if we don't remain compliant is really important.
And I think that sometimes that idea of what happened first, a lot of times we tend to want to blame the animal or the owner. Oh, they've been licking at their incision line and that's why they get an infection. If you just left the e-collar on, this wouldn't have happened or something like that. And that's a normal human reaction. I don't want to be the one who makes a mistake. So when it happens, I think what we also need to start considering is the animal licking at it because there is an infection there or because we have caused tissue irritation. So we need to kind of change our mindset as well and be a little bit more open to the fact that we all need to improve.
I absolutely love that. And, you know, I guess with that thought of the concern of and the need to improve without kind of tapping into our already existent imposter syndrome that is rampant in our industry. So coming from a really healthy mindset of improvement, it brings me to topic number two, because I think your number two complication is the scariest one for all of us. It's an absolute nightmare, intra-abdominal hemorrhage.
I agree. And I think that's the thing that our students fear the most. And I feel there's not a lot of evidence as to why we see intra-abdominal hemorrhage. And I think, of course, we're worried about how good are our ligatures. Is that a problem? But in my personal experience, obviously this is all anecdotal, but in my personal experience, I would say that the number one reason we see abdominal hemorrhage is that people don't make the incisions big enough. There seems to be this competition on who can make the smallest incision. And there seems to be the need to please the owner. Oh, I'm not going to clip very much, or look how small my incision is. And also, maybe perhaps people do that because they think it's faster. But realistically, if you have a small incision, you put more stress on the abdominal pedicles, so they're more likely to tear. It's harder to find the abdominal pedicles. And so you're putting more stress on the body wall and damaging it. And then when you put the clamps on the ovarian pedicles, if there's a lot of stress on the pedicles, your ligatures will end up right next to the clamps. And you cannot tighten down your ligatures appropriately if they are sitting next to the clamps. They have to be a distance away. It makes perfect sense if you stop and think about it, but we don't tend to stop and think about those things. So I would say that the number one problem we have is people trying to make small incisions. There's nothing wrong with a big incision. And another thing that's happened lately is the last three cases that have come in through our emergency service because of severe abdominal hemorrhage after a spay, those were all in large breed dogs that were spayed as adults. And the person was trying to make an incision that was 4 inches or less. And so we're trying to make a puppy size incision in an adult dog in an effort to either please the owner or because we haven't thought about it. And so I think that's probably the biggest take home is if you get an abdominal bleeder, it's probably because your incision wasn't big enough. Make a big incision. There's nothing wrong with that. You can tell the owner you're going to provide the best of care and look around while you're in there, and you'll do that free of charge. And then they'll be very pleased with the extra effort you made.
If you're already reading Clinician's Brief, why not get credit for it? Get affordable, race-approved CE from Clinician's Brief content you trust without leaving your desk. You can track your earned hours, receipts, and certificates and see the latest available courses at cliniciansbrief.com/CE. Get started today. You know, is setting up that expectation ahead of time. I think that's one thing that we really don't do, especially in these quote unquote common procedures. And so it's just catching the owner off guard. Maybe they didn't even realize you were going to shave their dog's abdomen. Maybe they didn't realize it wasn't laparoscopic because that's what the only surgery they've ever seen. I think we just get into this thing of like so common language for us. We forget to talk to our clients in a way as though that they have never experienced this before. And chances are, even if they have experienced it, no one's really explained it to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then if you can reassure them that this is going to heal fine, we still have to restrict the animals, but I'm also going to provide pain relievers so your dog will be comfortable. I think all of those things, that education that you're providing, that care that you're providing is going to reassure them. And it's going to just provide you with a better relationship with that owner.
Okay, so let's pick that back up. We've already talked about pain because I can't stop talking about analgesia and the fact that we are underserving our patients for years and years. Unfortunately, you know, I was watching a video online the other day, a veterinary technician posted, or a support staff member, I'm not sure of her credentials, of a puppy recovering from surgery and the vocalization, just a constant vocalization. And another technician weighed in and just kind of said that it was really sad to hear this dog carrying on this way and that it went on like that. And the personnel who posted it said, that's just kind of how surgery goes. Sometimes they don't always wake up the same. It kind of is what it is. It really made me sad because whether it was dysphoria, whether it was pain, of course, I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose, but I don't think we give enough respect to the pain management aspect of this. So tell me what your best practices are around gonadectomy. I mean, we're doing local blocks now, right? Like, what are we sending home? What's too much? What's not enough?
I think that's a really tough question because I think it depends on the patient. It depends on the skill of the surgeon. Here at the university, our spays and castrations are done by students. And so what I might see might be totally different than what would be seen out in a general practice. However, I think that multimodal is always going to be best. And you mentioned the local blocks. I think those are very, very important. And if we can do local blocks of the skin and muscle, that's going to provide some really good pain relief in those critical first 6 hours after the procedure. But that vocalization that we see, what's difficult is to tell, is that stress and anxiety? Is that an opioid recovery? Or is that true pain? And so for people to learn how to monitor pain in animals, I think that's a real key thing. One of the things we don't think about is just press on the incision line. If the animal tucks up or reacts strongly when you press on the incision line, that animal is in pain. You could definitely tell the difference between that and dysphoria if you're going to press on the incision line. And so that's really, really important, is to have those abilities or those training sessions with your people who are watching the recovery, is to say, this is what I want you to do, and this is what I want you to tell me. And then in terms of multimodal, I think there's been some great information out there about things like pre-treating with trazodone, decreasing MAC values. So it actually, by reducing anxiety, we actually reduce the amount of pain that the animal seems to be experiencing. And so I think that's really important. If we can make sure that these animals receive proper anti-anxiety medications before, during, or after, depending on your timing, and it's no problem to send an animal home on a couple of days worth of trazodone to keep them calm. That'll help the owner do the restriction as well. And then to do your local blocks, to give your pretreatment with your opioid. Those are going to last, depending on which drug you use. Maybe if you use buprenorphine, that's going to last 4 to 6 hours. And then to determine before you send the animal home, are they still painful when you're palpating the abdomen? Is an NSAID going to be sufficient, or do I need another injection of an opioid? And then usually sending home a couple days worth of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug would be good as well. Making sure that you have provided them with the information they need about potential complications.
Yeah. And I think it's really important too, to be up to date on what is being used and isn't. Like you said, it's a very individualized situation, but I just still hear things like tramadol being used as a pain reliever and almost on its own. And there's, I think, a lot of confusion and questions around the best analgesia. And I think we could do 10 podcasts in itself on that. I think the best advice I ever heard is just thinking about treating the dog in front of you and working your protocol around that. I see so many rigid protocols that I think to myself, well, but what if, right?
Yes. And I agree that it's an extensive topic. And what I appreciate about Clinician's Brief is how you guys can distill down some of these topics into something that's really easily understandable. And that's important when the topic is so broad, like analgesia, trying to help people understand what can they do. In my mind, the most important thing is, boy, if you squeeze that abdomen and they turn around and bite you, you better assume they're painful. You better.
Sure. Yeah, right. And like, what would I want? You know, would I be fine with popping a couple ibuprofen after you pulled my uterus out? Like, I think I'd want a little more than that. You know, I just, and we know animals are tough, but I mean, come on. All right. And you know, speaking of broad topics, number four is surgical errors, right? So that's pretty broad. But let's talk about those more common ones you discuss in your article and what you're seeing around that.
I guess if you're looking at errors that the surgeon has made, then there are some things I didn't really discuss, like choosing suture material. Honestly, it's always surprising to me when people choose something like a Maxon or PDS to close the sub-Q or the intradermal layer or to do their ligatures. That suture is there for 6 months, and there's no need for something to be there that long. And so that could be considered a surgical error if you have an animal that has irritation from a suture material that's there for too long of a period of time. If you are not cleaning your clippers and using sharp clipper blades, then the clipping that we do can damage the skin and increase the risk of infection. Is that a surgical error? Well, it's an error that occurs around surgery, and it's a simple thing that can be corrected. But without that correction, that can lead to some pretty serious issues. And then some of the things that we deal with, like for instance, when we were talking about leaving things in the abdomen like sponges, well, what they've learned in veterinary medicine, and particularly learned in human medicine, is the use of surgical checklists will decrease those errors dramatically. And so if you just have a checklist, do we have the same number of sponges that we started with? Have we given antibiotics in this case if it's recommended? Have we saved the tissues for submission to biopsy if that's recommended? All of those things will decrease the risk that we make, the risk that we'll have of having surgical errors.
I love checklists. I think they're so important, especially in an environment where we can't always control what happens around us and the order in which we get to approach them. And so I think having something to go back to make sure we don't overlook anything is incredibly important. And then last but not least, and again, I think this is an area we could probably do an entire podcast, but is these hormonal changes. And it goes back to something you said in the beginning, right? Spaying and neutering these tiny baby puppies at really young ages. And I just think that's a really interesting topic. So there's a lot of discussion around when and how we do spay and neuters, what age is best, and it's really been shaken up over the last couple of years.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we have two different camps, and I think that it's important to consider both sides. So on the one side, we have animals that if we spay and neuter them at a very early age, we don't have to worry about puppies or kittens being born inadvertently and then having overpopulation. And so early spays and neuters may be very important at animal shelters, rescue societies, places where we're trying to limit the population. And also in some cases that may increase adoption rates. And so if that improves the ability of an animal to find a home, I'm all for it because I'd rather have an animal that has a home than an animal that's been euthanized because of overpopulation. On the other hand, I think the data that's coming out about early spays and neuters, particularly for large breed dogs, is so critically important. And I think it's important for us to realize that the studies are not perfect studies. These are not randomized controlled studies. Nobody has taken litters of puppies and divided them in half and watched them for 15 years, but they're the best studies that we have. And to me, it makes so much sense that hormones are important for growth and development. And if we remove them during those critical stages, that can have negative effects. And that's what we're seeing in the Golden Retriever Lifetime Study. It's just dramatic, the amount of joint disease that dogs are having if they are spayed or castrated less than 6 months of age. And then the information that's out there about Rottweilers and sarcomas is shocking. If you have an animal that's neutered before 13 months of age, it has a 14% lifetime chance of having a sarcoma of bone. And if you leave them intact for 13 months, it's 7%. I mean, how incredible is that? That is such a serious condition. And so maybe it's going to be breed specific, maybe it's going to be size specific, but I do think we need to be thinking very carefully about neutering animals before they're mature.
One thing I think with that is it ties back into that treating that animal in front of you. One thing I think we get a little uncomfortable with in the veterinary industry is not having hard, fast rules. I think we're most comfortable with like science, and science is right all the time. It isn't variable. And so I think that's kind of where we get into a little bit of trouble where it's like, this is a matter of being flexible because like you said, we have to take the situation into consideration and that there isn't one hard, fast yes or no or rule. And I think that leads us to doing our best medicine because we can do the best medicine for the situation. And I think that helps take some internal pressure off of us of saying we have to do the best medicine for every situation, no matter what it is, because there's no perfect blanket answer.
Yeah, and that answer is going to change with every patient. I personally believe that large breed dogs should be left intact for a minimum of the first year of their life. And I have a feeling that if I had a Great Dane, I'd probably leave it intact longer because of those risks of joint disease. However, there may be some owners who absolutely cannot restrict their intact male dogs to prevent them from getting out and getting hit by a car or something like that. Maybe some of the behaviors they might have that might be hormonally driven, like, hey, I'm going to go find a female in heat. Or there are owners who may not be able to tolerate the fact that they've got a dog in heat. And so if they get rid of the dog because of that, that's not a good thing either. So it's going to have to be a case-by-case thing. But it's going to be really, really important for veterinarians to present the data to the owners too. Again, knowing that these are not perfect studies, if someone were to tell me that my golden retriever would have a 20 to 25% chance of getting osteoarthritis if I neutered it before 6 months of age, and if I left it intact for at least a year, it would be 10% or less, man, that's a big difference. That's a really significant difference to me. And I would leave my animal intact because of it. So giving owners the data and letting them decide what's most important is going to be really critical.
Yeah. And it doesn't open the door for them to say, you didn't tell me. It's just really giving them that information and helping them make the best decision. And I guess that kind of brings me conveniently and beautifully segues into our Keep It Brief, although we rarely ever do. So no pressure there. Talk to me a little bit about how you do prepare clients for possible complications. We think, again, spay and neuters are doing them out of buses. It's nothing, you know, and then the worst can happen. So how should we be best discussing potential complications with our clients?
I think starting at a very, very early stage in that doctor-patient-owner relationship. So when you're starting to see these animals as very young puppies, it's going to be important to start having these discussions so the owners can think ahead. How long do I want to keep this animal intact? If I leave this animal intact, what am I going to do? How am I going to care for it during those times when it's in heat or when he's out trying to roam the neighborhood? So starting with that, and then starting to have the discussions with the owners, what do the surgeries entail? And it may be that it would be good to have some website information or some brief handouts. We know owners only take in about 20% of what you say or what they read. And so some brief handouts on this is what the surgery is like, this is what we need to do. And then when you're preparing to make that appointment for them to bring the animal in for a spay or castration, to start going through that information again, to say, this is what this will entail. And I think it's also good to have some sort of release form. We do it for human medicine all the time. And it's important to have a release form that has some of the potential complications. Any animal can have an anesthetic complication. We know the risk is low, 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 for healthy animals, but it should be there. And the owners need to realize that. And then there will be some breed specific risks that we have to worry about. And so having the owners be aware of what can happen when you anesthetize a brachycephalic breed, or what could potentially happen if it's a Doberman and they haven't been tested for von Willebrands. We can't inform them of every potential complication. And so building that relationship, keeping the communication lines open is going to be important, because when there is a complication, you have to be the one who contacts them and says, this is what happened. It's why it's happened. I'm so sorry it happened. And here's what we're going to do to try and make it right. If we can't make it right, I just wanted you to understand. And there are a lot of owners who, knowing that there's that good relationship there between themselves and their veterinarian, are willing to accept those risks.
Yeah, I think you put it perfectly. And the idea is that there is no such thing as a routine surgery, right? We need to be understanding that all surgery has complications and has implications and be looking at them the right way. In fact, I have a lot of veterinary friends who cringe. And even in the editing of kind of the outline of this podcast, you know, we're like, hey, there's no such thing as a routine surgery. You can't even say that on this podcast because it gets beat into us in school. Nothing's routine and we should never think of it that way.
Very true. Maybe it's a frequent surgery.
Dr. Tobias, thank you so much for your time today. This amazing information. I know for a fact we'll have you back very soon, and we look forward to having another great conversation with you soon.
Sounds great.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com/cliniciansbrief, on Twitter at cliniciansbrief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief, the podcast, is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Moncrez.